First Nations people, Indigenous people, as well as peoples from all walks of life, color and creed, are having great concerns when it comes to the future of pipeline development, not only in Canada, but the United States. It's concerning that we see President-elect Trump indicating that he would take the Keystone XL project that was, you know, struck down by the Obama administration and pledged to build that pipeline going down. And I just have to say that for myself as the Manitoba regional chief, that pipeline should be coming through my region, and he's going to have a hard battle with our First Nations people on that side of the border.
Well, Regional Chief Kevin Hart, I want to thank you for being with us at the Assembly of First Nations Manitoba here in Marrakesh, Morocco, and thanks so much to Tara Hauska. That does it for our show. We'll be celebrating Democracy Now!'s 20th anniversary with Harry Belafonte, Noam Chomsky, Patti Smith, and many others, December 5th in New York City. Go to our website to join us and look at the details, democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman with an amazing team here in Morocco, Marrakesh. Mike Berkman, Shea Carla Wills, Laura Gottesdiener, Dina Guzder, Sam Alcroft, Robbie Karen. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for joining us.
You are listening to KBOO Portland.
KBOO Community Radio is proud to co-sponsor the Stepping Outside Polite Conversation Evening with the Tar Sands Valve Turners, Wednesday, November 16th at 7 p.m. at the Sunnyside Community House in Portland. Hear five of the Tar Sands Valve Turners share stories of their nonviolent direct actions that took place October 11th and hear about why they took this form of climate activism. Again, that's Stepping Outside Polite Conversation, an evening with the Tar Sands Valve Turners on Wednesday, November 16th at 7 p.m. at the Sunnyside Community House, 3520 Southeast Yamhill Street in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
On November 18th, from 8 p.m. until 10, from the grassroots, where we agitate for social change with music and commentary, we will focus on Mr. Gil Scott-Heron. Gil Scott-Heron established the attitude and stylistic vocabulary of socially conscious music in America. His music was powerful, his lyrics relevant, and his voice beautiful. So join us from the grassroots, November 18th from 8 to 10 p.m. on 90.7 FM, KBOO Portland.
And it's a couple minutes past five. KBOO Evening News is coming up next. This program has been made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from Portland's Gay Directory, providing a resource guide of openly gay-friendly businesses, organizations, and services since 1996. New smartphone app available for all iPhones and Androids. For more information, you can visit gaypdx.com.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News. Today, City Council voted no against more oil and natural gas terminals being built in the city of Portland.
Portland Resistance founder Gregory McKelvey is being scrutinized around the world right now. He answers tough questions about the Portland Resistance protest organization he just founded.
And a small crew of filmmakers is creating a documentary about how Portland made history on pushing back against the extreme right wing here a generation ago.
Good evening. This is KBOO Evening News for Wednesday, November 16th, 2016. I'm Ray Bodwell.
And I'm Erin J. Bernard. Today, City Council voted no against more oil and natural gas terminals being built in the city of Portland. Council members struck down an amendment to current policy that would have allowed a 10% increase in the development of fossil fuel infrastructure in the Northwest Industrial District along the Willamette River. Today's event comes on the heels of what was originally intended to be a final public hearing. It was extended due to an overwhelming number of people showing up to share their views. The city's Bureau of Planning and Sustainability is responsible for moving forward the proposal. 350.org has said that among their goals in calling attention to these city council hearings is to redefine what counts as a fossil fuel terminal. Currently, tanks under 2 million gallons do not count as terminals. 350 also seeks to win a mandate on existing terminals to provide seismic improvements to their infrastructure while preventing expansion. There was, and to a degree still is, a concern that city council was going to sneak in a last-minute exemption from the policy change for local utilities provider Northwest Natural. This appears to amount to a slight victory in the battle to amend city zoning policy, which will culminate on December 8th when City Council will vote to determine the fate of the entire fossil fuel terminal regulation package.
With one of the worst high school graduation rates in the country, virtually everyone agrees that Oregon's public schools are underfunded. Yet despite a well-organized campaign that was strongly backed by the Oregon Center for Public Policy, the Oregon PTA, and the state's teachers union, the measure went down to a resounding defeat. Earlier today, I spoke with Juan Carlos Ordonez of the Center for Public Policy to get his thoughts on why the measure failed and where we go from here. Juan Carlos, Oregon Measure 97 lost pretty decisively. What do you think are the primary reasons it lost so badly?
Well, I think part of the reason is that the opposition was flush with cash. They had $27 million at least to throw at the measure. So I think part of the story is that it shows that corporate money speaks loudly. And they also, you have to tip their hat at them, ran a very effective campaign in terms of their messaging. They ran simple messages, misleading, we think, messages, but nevertheless very simple and effective messages. You know, those simple messages were enough to cause doubt in the minds of a lot of voters. That said, I think that from what we can tell, there is still a great many Oregonians who are not happy with the level of funding of our schools and other public services, would definitely like to see us do better. The other issue, which seemed to resonate with folks, which again was sort of misleading, was the notion that the legislature could spend the money any way it wanted. And that also was a concern to voters. But again, I think that was not really an accurate message. But nevertheless, those two messages seem to have carried the day for the no sign.
I look at Measure 98. Measure 98 requires funding for dropout prevention, and it passed. In view of the fact that Measure 97 didn't pass, and all agreed that the schools are significantly underfunded at this point, where will the funding come from for Measure 98?
You know, I'm not an expert on Measure 98, but my understanding is that it will come from the general fund. They will be diverting some monies from it, so I think it makes the current budget situation more difficult.
Recently, your website noted that there would be a $1.4 billion budget shortfall. That number has actually been revised upwards to $1.7 billion. I assume much of the increase in shortfall is associated with the public employee retirement system shortfall?
Yes, it does factor in. And it's due to the fact that in 2013, the legislature was warned that the changes that they were making to PERS may not pass constitutional muster. They were warned, but nevertheless went ahead with it. And so now some of it is that we're paying back the costs that have accrued as a result of the failure of those reforms.
The Oregon Center for Public Policy, the Oregon PTA, the teachers' unions, they all stressed Measure 97 was actually a must, yet Measure 97 failed. Now what happens?
Yes, I mean, I think that part of it we have to recognize that we have gone from a situation where there was hope that we were finally going to confront the long-term chronic underfunding of schools and other key services. We've gone from a situation where we were potentially really upgrading our schools and other social infrastructure to a situation where we're facing a $1.7 billion hole. So the priority right now needs to be to fill in the gap to avoid further erosion of our schools and other key services. So we will be looking at ways to for the state to close some tax loopholes that benefit corporations and the very wealthy. I think that it makes a lot of sense to look there first. We also think that it's really time for Oregon to enact corporate tax disclosure. Part of the difficulty in enacting Measure 97 was that there were a lot of companies making claims as to how they would be impacted by the measure, which may have been true or may not have been true. But Oregonians, the public and lawmakers and the media have no way of really knowing without being able to see corporations' tax returns. So it really is time for us to require corporations to make their tax information public. And Oregonians that way will be able to know which corporations are good citizens and pay their taxes, pay their fair share in taxes, and which ones don't, and which tax loopholes they're using to their advantage.
Juan Carlos, thank you so much for your time. For KBOO, this is Ray Bodwell.
When is having a million more votes than your opponent not a victory? When the legal system considers the Electoral College over the will of the majority of people. Currently, Clinton has over a million more votes than Donald Trump in the national count. Both Richard Nixon and John F. Kennedy won their elections by less than a million votes. Since most of the votes not yet counted are on the West Coast, where Hillary had substantial margins in most states, her total popular victory is expected to be close to 2 million. California Senator Barbara Boxer introduced a bill today to eliminate the Electoral College through a constitutional amendment. Since Republicans control both the House and Senate, her bill has little chance of succeeding. For a constitutional amendment to become law, it also needs to be approved by the president and 38 of the 50 state legislatures.
Portland Resistance founder Gregory McKelvey is being scrutinized around the world right now. McKelvey is a law student and grassroots organizer who became active in the Bernie Sanders campaign before starting up a peaceful protest organization last week in the wake of the presidential election results. McKelvey was a guest of KBOO's Cutie Pock talk last night. He answered tough questions texted into Studio 2 and dispelled a few rumors about Portland Resistance's work and who was marching in the streets. Darian Jones starts the questions.
Trying to stop. And so is it true that, since you're leading these peaceful protesters, that the police are working with you? Because what looks identified to me in the media when they say peaceful protesters, it doesn't like any people of color. People of color look like the people the police are chasing.
Yeah, we're scary.
Yeah,
so,
especially like when you have a megaphone. Black person with a megaphone, that's scary. Okay, I will never and have never spoken or collaborated or talked to or snitched to or had anything to do with the police. I can't stand the police, and I have a long history of dealing with the Portland police, getting beat by the Portland police, being pepper sprayed by the Portland police, being handcuffed by the Portland police. I don't mess with the police whatsoever. And honestly, I don't think that there is anybody giving them any information. If there was, we would have seen charges other than disorderly conduct. We would have seen people charged with destroying property and vandalism and stuff like that. So I don't think there is not one peaceful protester. I wouldn't be surprised if there was somebody that had never protested before that was like, hey, I saw some scary stuff. But there's nobody like pointing people out or anything. And like Mike Marshman said something the other day that like if we want to protest or something, you just call us. We'll give you a permit. We'll even make the route for you. We're protesting you. Why would we want you to make our route when we're protesting you? Why would do you think the people that are throwing tea into the Boston Harbor got a permit to throw the tea into the harbor? No, of course not. We can't protest the state and then ask the state to help us do it. Charlie Hales also said that you have to do more than protesting. You have to engage in the political process. Protesting is the political process. There's nothing more patriotic. There's nothing that forces change more than protesting. And it's a huge part of the political process. Not to mention, I did try and get involved in the political process and go to City Hall and testify against the police union contract. And he beat myself, my whole group, men, women, children, disabled, elderly people out of City Hall. So to say, oh, just come in to City Hall, engage in the political process. We tried that and you beat us out. So no, I have no interest in talking to the police. I will not ever sit down with the police, and I have sat down with Charlie Hales before, and I will never do it again because I lost all respect for him after I saw him beat men, women, children, disabled, elderly people out of City Hall.
And so, wow. So when we think about that and this situation with the police and how they're supposed to be, you know, our protectors, our guardians here in Portland, I really am curious to know about, you know, your safety and the safety of kind of all of the organizers that are working for Portland's resistance, because I know at the, you know, the vigil, there was a discussion that's kind of started in the middle about the fact that a lot of the organizers in the group have had their, you know, photos posted on Craigslist with, you know, essentially bounties out for them and their imprisonment and essentially their death. And it's terrible. And I really, you know, want to know what is the best way that we can kind of, you know, make sure that you're safe and, you know, the organizers are safe and the real realities of that, because there is a neo-Nazi movement that's coming up here in Portland.
So I'm under constant death threat, but I have been for some time. Before this happened, it's definitely amped up. I just watched a whole episode on myself on conservative conspiracy show about how I'm a DNC plant funded by George Soros, and I'm like, I wish. But what's funny is the cops say protect and to serve. We're the ones under constant threat. Yet at a rally or a march, they're sitting pointing towards us. What they should be doing is looking the other way, watching out for these neo-Nazis and these, you know, extremist patriots, watching out for them, because they're the ones that are threatening me all the time. I've never once threatened somebody's life. But at the same time, I don't work with the police, so I've never once told the police, hey, I'm under death threat, because I honestly feel like I'm under the biggest death threat when I'm around the police. With that said, while I am under a constant threat of death and stuff, and it is, you know, I'm not going to lie, it's scary, but I think there's only two ways for this to end for me, and that is in my death or in completely flipping the table in Portland and seeing a political revolution here. So I'm going to keep fighting until one of those two things happens. But what I'm worried about is all these people, and I shame on the Oregonian for publishing all these faces and those names of everybody arrested, including people that were underage.
Awful.
Posting all of that, because now every single one of them is getting death threats, and that's who I worry about, because a lot of these people had never been in the streets before. These people are now terrified, and so who knows if they're gonna, what I would say, engage in the political process in protesting, or as, you know, our police call rioting, but who knows if they're going to do this anymore, because, you know, these people are now threatening them, and we also have to talk about the fact that these threats are real. These are not empty Facebook threats or anything like that. These are unstable people. They're militia members. They open carry, have all sorts of guns all over the place, and this is what they've been waiting for, to be emboldened to do this kind of stuff. I mean, we've seen Trump supporters come out the woodwork that were never saying anything, and then when Trump won, they're like, yep, I'm loading up. And it's the people that were just peacefully protesting that I worry about. And also, nobody's looking into the fact that, one, all those charges were dropped or, you know, are made into violations. They can bring them back later, but they're not going to, because there's no evidence, because they didn't do anything other than peacefully protest. They're arrested for disorderly conduct or interfering with the peace officer, which is code for, I arrested you for peacefully protesting. And then they're getting threats, as if they were the ones doing any sort of destruction to the city, yet not one of them has been charged with doing destruction to the city. So they come to peacefully protest. Now they're under constant threat. And those are the people that I worry about the most, not myself. And that's our number one priority for Portland's resistance right now. It's not the money. It's not, you know, more protests or anything like that. It's the fact that these threats are real and we need to keep these people safe. And so that's why you've seen less of us into the streets and less of us talking about funds or anything like that, because the number one thing I'm thinking about right now is making sure that people live through this.
That was Gregory McKelvey on Cutie Pock Talk last night. He said after the show that he did not refer to the president-elect as Donald Chump. It just sounded like that.
You are listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned for What's Life Without Laughter at 6, followed by Free Culture Radio at 6:30. At 7, it's Hard Knock Radio, news and views from a hip-hop perspective. Tomorrow's weather is rainy, highs around 51 degrees. Today in history, in 1959, everyone's second favorite musical about Nazis opened on Broadway. The Sound of Music featured the true life story of the Von Trapp family singers who escaped the Nazis by hiking across the Alps. Of course, everyone's favorite musical about Nazis was called Springtime for Hitler, the play within a Broadway play called The Producers. The quote of the day is from Max Bialystock, who said, "How could this happen? I was so careful. I picked the wrong play, the wrong director, the wrong cast. Where did I go right?" Kevin Allred, who teaches women's and gender studies at Rutgers University in New Jersey, was arrested yesterday for comments he made on campus in Twitter. One of these remarks was, "Would people feel the same way about being so lenient with the Second Amendment if people went out and got guns to shoot random white people?" Reacting to a student complaint, Rutgers campus police decided Allred was a threat and called the New York Police Department, who went to Allred's home in New York. They told him, "You're not under arrest, but if you don't go with us, we'll take you by force." Allred was taken in an ambulance to Bellevue Hospital, made to undergo a psychiatric examination, and released 2 hours later when doctors concluded he had no psychiatric issues.
On Wednesday, Twitter moved to block the accounts of white supremacists and hate mongers who cheered Donald Trump. The move follows an earlier announcement by the microblogging site that it was providing additional tools to allow users to block abusive internet trolls. Among those blocked was Richard Spencer, president of the National Policy Institute, a white nationalist think tank. Spencer called the blocking of his digital presence as, quote, corporate Stalinism, but Twitter responded by referring to the rules prohibiting threats, harassment, and hateful conduct, noting that abuse, bullying, and harassment has increased dramatically over the last few years. Twitter has introduced three ways to fight back against the internet trolls. Users can mute notifications based on keywords and phrases, and it is now easier to report abusive users. The company also says it has retrained its support team to identify and block hateful conduct. In a similar vein, Facebook and Google have announced that they are looking at ways to actively block fake news sites.
Across India, people are panicking after the government declared all 501,000 rupee bills will be worthless by the end of the year. Banks are short on cash, and sporadic violence has broken out as long lines form at ATMs. FSRN's Jasvinder Shigal reports.
Hundreds of people are lined up in front of the UCO Bank at Johri Bazaar in the western Indian city of Jaipur, desperate to exchange now useless 500 and 1,000 rupee currency notes. But many banks are out of cash, and ATMs have run dry. The cash crunch was triggered by a government move to staunch the flow of counterfeit currency and block the rampant bribe system in the country. Last Tuesday, Indian Prime Minister Narendra Modi devalidated the two denominations in a bid to crack down on the illicit money. Most black money in India is paid in the form of 500 and 1,000 rupee bills, the equivalent of about $7 and $15 respectively. But the move caused a financial panic, as the notes are the most commonly used currency denominations. It's 1 p.m. and 40-year-old shopkeeper Javed Ali has been standing in line since morning.
The public is facing a severe problem. The new currency denominations haven't been adequately distributed to banks. Because of the heavy demand, currency runs out in a few hours. I have gone to many banks, and the problem is the same all over. The government should have taken proper steps before putting the new policy in place.
The old currency must be exchanged, but there are limits. Banks will only exchange the equivalent of about $67 per day, with a maximum of about $3,700 that can be exchanged before the end of this year. Many businesses are having trouble paying daily wages, and some are refusing to accept the bills for payment of services. And many will have difficulty converting cash holdings because now they have to declare them to the tax authorities. Money that cannot be exchanged will be, as officials put it, extinguished. But not all are upset by the move and say that they can bear the brunt of the cash strain to get countries' black money, often used to fund terrorism, out of circulation. Jaswinder Sehgal, FSRN, Jaipur, India.
Earlier today, Portland's Sacramento Elementary School hosted the nation's first meeting of the After School Satan Club. The club is sponsored by the Satanic Temple, an organization based in Salem, Massachusetts. The group points out that it is non-theistic and does not believe in Satan. They claim to encourage benevolence and empathy, reject tyrannical authority, and advocate common sense and justice. The group also states that the Satan Club is a counterbalance to the Evangelical Good News Club. The Good News Club is a Bible-based after-school program whose stated purpose is to evangelize boys and girls with the gospel. Four members of a Catholic group called America Needs Fatima traveled to Portland to protest against the Satan Club. They were joined by some members of the community and a priest who reportedly happened to be visiting from Ohio.
KBOO News poet Dan Raphael wants to shake off his post-election grief and make more positive changes around him.
I want to snap out of all this grieving. This is my country too, and I'm not leaving. While I'm not sure what all makes America great, I know it's not racism, misogyny, or hate. We can't let the 1% of violent, bigoted white folk ruin our future energies and cause our progress to choke. Only bad news makes the headlines. Kindness and bravery don't sell. You know all change is local. We each have small victories to tell. I won't let Trump spoil 1 minute of my day, for even in the darkest night, love and wisdom will find a way. For KBOO Poetic Justice, this is Dan Raphael. Tough times, tough on the outside, be tender within.
And now we hear the latest in worker-related news from our friends at laborradio.org.
You're listening to WIN, Workers Independent News, a production of Diversified Media Enterprises. I'm Doug Cunningham. Illinois state union workers are closely watching to see what the state's labor board does. The board could order Governor Bruce Rauner back to the bargaining table with AFSCME state employees, or it could accept Rauner's claim that talks are at an impasse. If an impasse is declared, Rauner is expected to try to unilaterally impose his demands on state employees. AFSCME Council 31 is calling for the Rauner administration to resume contract negotiations with state workers. The anti-union governor broke off negotiations with AFSCME back in January. AFSCME says although it has a strong case at the labor board, the board members are appointed by Governor Rauner. SEIU Local 26 says a majority of AirServe Corporation workers have signed union representation cards. AirServe is a Delta Airlines subcontractor at Minneapolis-St. Paul International Airport. SEIU says hundreds of workers signed up to be new members. They are baggage handlers, cabin cleaners, cart drivers, wheelchair agents, and other service workers. SEIU has been organizing airport workers in Minneapolis for years. Unless a new agreement is reached, 700 Harvard University janitors could strike. The old contract was set to expire at the end of Tuesday. SEIU 32BJ represents the Harvard janitors. They voted to authorize a strike days ago. The union may or may not immediately call a strike at midnight Tuesday. If progress is being made in the talks, the union leaders can decide to stay and talk rather than striking. The Harvard janitors want cost-of-living wage hikes, more full-time jobs, and affordable health care. SEIU says Harvard janitors make an average of $21.87 an hour. RIP TPP. Public Citizen Global Trade Watch Director Lori Wallach says it was people power organized against the TPP trade agreement for years that led to the decision by the White House and GOP congressional leaders to drop efforts to pass the trade agreement. Wallach says it's welcome news because the TPP wouldn't have helped workers. She says it expanded corporate power and shrank American wages. Wallach says a six-year, relentless strategic campaign was waged against the TPP.
Brought to you by Blue Cross Blue Shield National Labor Office, empowering working Americans with stable health coverage for over 50 years. The National Labor Office is committed to remaining the top choice for the 17 million union workers, retirees, and families they serve. Online at bcbs.com/NLO.
WIN is brought to you in part by the Amalgamated Transit Union, the largest labor union representing transit and allied workers in the U.S. and Canada. online at atu.org.
Workers Independent News is proud to be heard on The Union Edge, Labor's Talk Radio. Live nationwide weekdays, noon to 3 p.m. at theunionedge.com.
You've been listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call us with your breaking news stories at 503-231-8032. Our production team for tonight's newscast is Dan Raphael, Ray Bodwell, Tommy Hollywood, Paul Roland, and Chris Andre. Special thanks to Free Speech Radio News and the QTPOC Collective. Our engineer is David Kesters. The KBOO Evening News and Public Affairs Director is Lisa Loving. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You can also find us on Facebook and Twitter at KBOO News. You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Aaron J. Bernard.
And I'm Ray Bodwell. Coming up tomorrow morning on KBOO, at 7, it's Democracy Now! With Amy Goodman and Juan Gonzalez. At 8, on Voices from the Edge, Joanna Hardesty welcomes Ibrahim Mubarak from Right to Survive to discuss the plan to move the community rest area. At 9, on Press Watch, Teresa Mitchell talks general strike to stop the Trumpocalypse. At 9:30, on Fight the Empire, Per asks, should Donald Trump engage with Russia to promote global peace, or is he simply Putin's stooge? At 10, it's Air Cascadia with Chris Andre. At 10:15, it's Flashpoints with host David Bernstein. At 11, on Between the Covers, host David Naiman talks to author Tayahimba Jess, whose book Olio presents a musical history of the long fight against slavery and a subversive account of how black musicians have been exploited. Thanks, KBOO members, for your generous support. Not a current member? You can become one by going to KBOO FM and clicking on Donate.
Listening to the KBOO Evening News, I'm Lisa Loving. We have a special interview now. The nation is reeling from the recent election of an Islamophobic right-wing president. Meanwhile, there's a small crew of filmmakers creating a documentary about how Portland made history on pushing back against the extreme right wing here a generation ago, right? It makes a person wonder whether activist knowledge from the past can help progressive people today push forward through what looks like potentially a white nationalist government elect, saying that. We're joined here live in Studio 2 by Jeff Crawford and Thalia Zapatos. Thanks for coming in tonight.
Thanks.
Thanks for inviting us.
We're also joined by Jennifer Harris Crawford. She's being silent, you know, off the microphone. We don't have enough microphones to go around. This film is a big deal. I just want to start out in saying, you're working about this documentary. It started out about one concert. One night in one hell of a nasty political campaign from 1992. The show was a benefit to raise funds to fight back an anti-queer ballot measure that it essentially would make it against the law to be gay in Oregon. I'm putting that up. We'll talk about that in a second. But I want to start by asking Jeff and Thalia, what was Measure 9? Because this documentary is about one concert on one night in 1992 that was a benefit for the No on 9 campaign. Right? They're pointing at each other. What was Measure 9 and what impact did it have on young people's political motivation in the city of Portland, Oregon in 1992?
Well, ballot measure 9 was a statewide ballot question put on the ballot by the Oregon Citizens Alliance. They had just formed a few years before in 1988. And the measure actually tried to amend the Constitution of the state of Oregon to say that homosexuality was abnormal and perverse, and that no state funds would be spent to promote it. And it was very vague about what that would mean, but our, you know, folks from the community and legal experts theorized that LGBT teachers could be fired from their jobs, that books would be taken off of library shelves and we would have censorship, that money to fight AIDS, which was a huge problem at the time, could be cut, that there would be repercussions, and of course it would be basically state-sanctioned homophobia and transphobia. And it was a horrific measure that really led to a very, very difficult and divisive campaign, which we ultimately won.
Okay, so there was a show.
Yeah.
There was a rock and roll show. Let's just talk about the show. The show that was the benefit for the No Online campaign that you started out this documentary about. Who was the headliner that night? Where was
Nirvana.
It?
Nirvana was the headliner. And started out with, there weren't planned to be on the headliner. It was going to be 20-foot man, which is a performance art type of
sculpture, live sculpture, like pre-Burning Man thing.
Correct. And then it was Calamity Jane, local gals that are cool as anything, and Poison Idea. And then that was the plan. And then Nirvana came in and decided to help out.
And then, was it at Satyricon? Where was the show?
It was at Portland Meadows.
Oh, so it was a stadium show. It was a stadium show in a wooden hammer stadium.
It was a huge show.
Yeah. Yeah.
It was one of the first outdoor events near the city, you know, for a benefit concert like this on that large of a scale.
And paint the picture a little bit. What was the mood that night? Who was the fan base?
The fan base was, since Helmet was playing, it was like a metal crowd a little bit. Then there was like the local crowd. Then there's people coming in from all over else. So it was a mixture of diversity as far as musical taste.
Right. So there's a show. People are coming. People are freaked out. And when we're talking about homophobia in 1992, it was a bit more of an edgy thing than it is now, right? Yeah. What was the feel like? What was it like?
I think there was a lot of tension and paranoia and fear, a lot of fear amongst the music community in Portland at the time too. I know that. Speaking for myself, I just couldn't believe it. It could happen in Oregon, something like this, you know. Mm-hmm. So
there were ugly incidents. There were hate-based incidents. There was violence all across the state. From inside the campaign office, we got phone calls every single day telling us that people who had No Online bumper stickers, their cars were being pushed off the road and driven off the road, that not only were lawn signs taken down, that people who hung signs in trees, you know, the whole tree had been chopped down and their dog had been shot. I mean, there were very, very ugly incidents that led up to, you know, two people being murdered in Salem. There was a Molotov cocktail thrown into the apartment of a African-American lesbian woman named Hattie Mae Cohens, her roommate, who was a white gay man who had a disability. They were killed by a group of skinheads. And it was kind of a single incident that epitomized the increasing feeling day after day and week after week of fear and hate that was going across our state.
Okay, I want to jump ahead a little. I want to jump ahead in time. I'm going to talk a bit with you about this film for the rest of our lives. I'm fascinated by it, okay? And I want to come back to it in a minute. But have you been struck by, you've been working on this project for a while now, and then we've had this presidential election that seems to have changed our, well, for white people, it seems to make the country look different. People of color saw this already. But can you talk about what your thoughts are right now about the project you're doing? And I want to jump ahead and say, what lessons can we learn from what people did, this concert show and all the activism?
I just think accountability of people's actions. You know, like letting Lon Mabon and Scott Lively and not being accountable except for Catherine Stufford, you know, suing her and him spending a few nights in jail. But outside of that,
Scott Lively was an activist with the Oregon Citizens Alliance who actually physically assaulted Catherine. And that was that's a whole other separate chapter. But yeah, one of the things that strikes me is that we do have young people marching in the street right now, very young people. And we just had this an interview with Gregory McKelvey. A lot of these young people are under 30. They've never marched before. So you're talking about accountability and political accountability, but as I want to kind of turn to Thalia and say, we got the show, the concert, this amazing project. It's growing. Your film project is growing, and part of it is because you're realizing what an important historical moment that was. And Thalia, talk a little bit about the political activism that came from literally people grooving to Nirvana, you know what I'm saying? We're talking about music, it's popular music, but it's more than that. Where did it go, Thalia?
Well, I'll say this about the parallel. I mean, I feel now this week, since Trump was elected, more of that feeling of dread, of oppression, of you know, kind of a heavy, hateful presence that's starting to press down on everyone. I mean, it has reminded me more of those months of the No on Nine campaign than any other period of time that I can recall in my own sort of activist history. But what I know from the No on Nine campaign was the antidote to that fear was that allies stood up and people stood up for each other. People turned out. People came out for canvassing. People went door to door. It was scary. People were afraid to knock on someone's door because they didn't know who would be behind that door and what their reaction would be. But we teamed people up. They went two by two. There was this incredible sense of people, you know, watching out for one another because that was the only way we felt we could get through it. And I think if there is one immediate response, and I hope we will all participate in it and see more and more, it's we've got to show up as allies for each other.
Mm. And what can people today, particularly I'm thinking about young people, learn from the radical arts and politics movements taking place in Portland a generation ago? What's relevant?
I think what's, you know, relevant, the history of lessons of the past. And then if people could reflect what we learned, you know, the mistakes we made, and we got to learn from our mistakes and correct them right now. We need to forge ahead, move ahead, and set aside differences right now, and especially political ideologies.
Well, I might say that just the joining together, and maybe this is part of the response to being under attack. I mean, this concert that started Jeff and Jennifer on the film was one of many. I mean, there was a Poets and Writers Against Measure 9
event.
What
happened when this hit the national?
There were other
concerts.
I mean, there were things that happened like almost every week. Somebody came forward and said, we're going to organize this whole thing and give you all the money and we hope you can show up. But whether or not you can, we're going to do this for the campaign. And so people came together and they brought whatever artistic talent they had, whatever community they had, whatever group they could organize together all for the common good.
One of the things that strikes me too is that now we live in a generation and age when people are really beginning to understand our own sexuality, and people are not going for, you know, I'm either a he or a she. Back then things were a little different. I'm going to say there have always been people with wisdom about that, but back then when you're talking about all those bands that came out on No on Nine, people didn't really have to do that. I'm putting that out. People were sticking their necks out for a community of people that were embattled. And you didn't really get a whole lot of street cred in your family or anything from doing that. It was a different time. These were people taking the first crowbars bars to the mind in our town. I mean, can you just talk about that a little bit, Jeff? Like giving the respect to very young people who seem like they're sort of scruffy or don't know what's going on, which is exactly what's happening with the people in the street that we've seen arrested. Can just talk about like young people not having the respect of the institution, but they're moving forward and doing their thing.
They got to listen to us, the elders of the movements of the past. I know it's hard to say that and make them do that, and you can't lead them to doing that, but try to keep driving to that message to them that you got to do everything peacefully. the few handful of anarchists that have been causing these problems are being focused on through the national media. Portland's a problem because of this. You know, and if everybody was peaceful, we'd get more done than creating violence or vandalism.
The labels are a part of that too. So I think we're almost ready to close out. Just a last couple of questions. How can people support your effort? And do you have a name? What is it called?
It's called No on Nine.
Right on. How can people support where where are you with it?
Well, right now we're almost done with production, 99% done with production. And we should have been done in November, but we had to get a couple more interviews because of things of developing. Who would know? Who would know this would be developed into this type of film at this point? So right now is like, yeah, we're going to enter post-production, and we're trying to raise funds for that. We're going to start crowdfunding real soon. We have a crowdfunder. We have a GoFundMe. It's GoFundMe.com at NOAH9.
Okay.
We have that right now.
Right on.
So we have, you know, social networking. We have Facebook, Instagram, and all that other stuff. But people can donate to the film anytime, any $0 to $1 million if they want.
Awesome, awesome. We've got like 30 seconds left. Thalia's got an interesting thing too.
Yeah, well, a lot of people may not know that Oregon was also a testing ground for the successful message that won marriage equality nationwide. And there is another documentary that's just been released called The Freedom to Marry, and it's going to have its first showing here in Portland as part of the QDoc Film Festival Monday, December 12th at the Hollywood Theater at 7 p.m. This is such brand new news. It's not even on their website yet at the Hollywood Theater or the queerdocfest.org, but you will find it there listed. 12-12, go to Hollywood Theater and see a movie about another piece of important campaign history that affected us here in Oregon.
Come back on the air in December, and we'll talk about it more.
We'd love to. Thanks.
Right on. Thanks to you both. That's Thalia Zapatos, Jeff and Jennifer Harris Crawford. They and Mike Lastra are producing the documentary on us. Let's just call it that. Measure 9. And look for them on GoFundMe. And stay tuned. We're coming back with news from the Boo.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And now it's time for News from the Boo, the weekly segment from people inside of and around KBOO with news